This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Christopher Tillman is known to some as the Bard of the Borderland. His many stories and novels, including the acclaimed Mason's Retreat, are set on the eastern shore of Maryland. It's a place where land and water meet and sometimes battle for territory. It's north of the Mason-Dixon line, but it's had its share of slave-owning plantations, and its soil can be fertile and hostile, and its history often hard to get a handle on. Christopher Tillman's new novel is called The Right Hand Shore. It's a prequel to Mason's Retreat. The book tells the story of the family property that is the landscape for most of Tillman's work. The property is land that bears the blood and scars of many generations, of many families, black and white, slave and owners, slaves and freed slaves, industrialists, farmers, and entrepreneurs. Christopher Tillman reads at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on Monday night, but first joins me from the studios of the Virginia Center for the Humanities in Charlottesville. Christopher, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Well, good to be here. Thank you very much.
Right Hand Shore is a prequel to Mason's Retreat. Let's start with that book, Mason's Retreat, if you don't mind. It takes place just before World War II. What happened in that book that left you with unanswered questions?
Well, Mason's Retreat is about a expatriate, failed businessman, Edward Mason, who brings his family back from England in the middle of the Depression to the only place on earth he still owns, which is this crumbling, decaying, once grand estate on the eastern shore called Mason's Retreat. And it's been bequeathed to him by a maiden aunt that he hardly knew he had. So really, for me, I knew I was starting this story halfway through the question of, well, how did the farm end up in the hands of just this one rather sort of lonely and kind of embittered woman? How is it that there were no other heirs, that she simply sort of threw it at this man? And really, what was the history behind it? So I finished Mason's Retreat and spent a few years thinking about how I might pick up the story, and it took me 15 to figure that out. And what came out of it is this book.
Now, I know that you don't, you know, think of yourself as a kind of committed family historian, but you do have personal ties on the eastern shore, don't you?
Yes, I sure do. The whole Mason's Retreat, the farm really is modeled after my own family farm that my three brothers and I now own. It's been in this Tillman family since the very beginning on the eastern shore. And I do try and stay away from too much Tillmanizing, as I think of it. But as a person looking for bits and shards of material and the stories and legends I grew up with, I mine those like crazy. So it's a lot of it's pretty identifiable to at least my brothers and a few other close family friends.
Let's talk about The Right Hand Shore now, your latest book. Tell us about Miss Ophelia.
Well, the book starts really covers the period 1857 to about 1920, and Miss Ophelia is the daughter of the current owner before the war, she is 15 when the book starts in a scene of her father selling off the slaves in a most sort of brutal, calculated attempt to move on and to avoid the reprisals that he thinks is coming after what is certain to be the war. And Ophelia is this young woman who is scarred for the rest of the book by this experience of the selling of the slaves and the turmoil before the Civil War on the Eastern Shore.
Will you read from us from a section that is, in fact, takes place at that very moment?
Yes, this is Ophelia in the field. Her father has decided that he's going to sell off the slaves and simply herds them into a field by the Chester River, and a man from Virginia, of course, in a schooner comes up and sort of buys the lot of them, and they are standing in this field watching these poor people get herded onto the boat, and there's a group of all the whites there, including people who are very hostile to this decision of this man to to sell the slaves. He's not doing it out of any kindness, believe me. So here's Ophelia, and the question has been asked, well, what are you going to do with for labor if you're selling all these the slaves? And Ophelia's brother has just pointed to a third group of people standing there, or the freed blacks. So here's the little scene. Ophelia had not noticed this third group and had not realized that the house slaves, Hattie's Mary and Solomon and Betty and Ruth and the two boys were being spared, and that the free families in Tuckertown, the Hardys and Holidays and Terrells, weren't going anywhere. Abel Terrell was just a boy then. The next morning, Pickle Hardy, uncle to about 20 of the slaves in the line, would be harnessing the mules back at the retreat, and the free blacks would be doing there, doing for wages what the slaves had been doing yesterday for nothing. Homo economicus, doing what made sense all around. Ophelia had overheard her father arguing this with his fellow slave owners. "Don't this make sense?" he asked. "Pay them for just the exact amount of labor you need?" And the free blacks were the best of the lot anyway, proven and self-selected, people of strength and courage, people who could take charge. Suddenly Ophelia felt better. The mean slaves, the scary ones, were getting on the boat, and the nice people, those who had always greeted her and made a fuss about her red hair, they were staying. She breathed out, and this relaxing breath felt good, like a nice stretch in the morning while still in bed. And that was how she became conscripted into the very heart of this day. And this moment of relief and joy and even gratitude to her father was a shame she bore for the rest of her life. But that's the way it was in Maryland in those days. In the North, there was one principle, one war, one story. In the South, one cause, one defense, one history. But in the borders, in the middle ground, there were as many principles and wars and histories as there were human beings to hold them, to survive them, to preserve them.
Christopher Tillman, reading from his latest novel, The Right Hand Shore. He's going to be at Quail Ridge Books and Music on Monday at 7:30. He's on our program today. So much in that passage to talk about. I want to start with, you use a phrase in there, conscripted into the very heart, which I think resonates throughout, before and after. The idea that there are the mean slaves, these bodies that scare her, the fear of black bodies among white people who lived in that border region between freedom and slavery, seen through the eyes of this, in a sense, innocent white girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's that fear sort of continues for her as I continue the story quite briefly after that, of just before the war, there were on the Eastern Shore any number of rumors of slave insurrections. Of course, the Nat Turner Revolt had changed everything in that regard all through the South, the feeling that this could happen. And so Ophelia, raised as this teenager in horror and fear, in her own sort of relief and in her own continued anxieties, finally, in the end, just wants nothing to do with the Eastern Shore and with this farm ever again. And that's really one of the main plot points, that when she marries, finally, she really raises her daughter on the Western Shore in Baltimore, and her husband stays behind on the Eastern Shore and raises their son.
And yet the power of this is that these things are conscripted in the heart. So you can run away from the land if you want, but the story in one way or another stays with you and with those enslaved people who lost their families and were sent away. And the story comes back to you in various ways. You know, there's something interesting that I read about when you researched this, that you didn't know much about this story, but found that people who were descendants of the enslaved people who lived there knew everything about it.
Yes, it was. It was when I published Mason's Retreat in 1996, there were lots of things I didn't know. And as you've introduced me correctly as not a family historian, maybe that's not so surprising. But over time, I became aware that really the slaveholding on my family's place was very large until very late. In fact, I've found an inventory of the will of one of the Tillmans who died there in 1853 with 60 human beings listed in his property. And I began to ask around, well, what was that all about? How did that happen? It was a huge slaveholding for that part of the world at that time. And this story of before the war, this preemptory sale in this calculated attempt to, as I say, to avoid potential reprisals, began to emerge. And one man in particular, a white man, had worked on our farm for many years and worked alongside the black communities and was very much a friend of the black communities, that told me this story. And I said, well, how do you know this? And he said, well, they've been talking about this and the black communities for decades.
Fascinating, isn't it, that the family that was in possession of the land all this time and really in possession of the history, gets to write the history, lost the story, and the story remains alive among those who are dispossessed utterly.
Yes, and these stories do come back, of course, as legends. They come back somewhat prettied up or uglied down, depending on who's telling them. So you have to, as a novelist trying to take this material and simply create a plot that does what I want it to do, you have to drive a sort of a middle course too. So I don't know what really happened. And the truth is, I could probably find out a lot of this if I wanted to go over to Baltimore and spend a couple of days in the Historical Society, but I really don't. I'm really not interested in it.
Well, a plot that you create and a theme that you're deeply interested in, this idea of the borderland. And we talked about it earlier, and I would like to have you talk a little bit more about Ophelia's father. This calculation he makes on the threshold of the Civil War, about whether or not to keep his slaves. Give us the details. What was it he was looking at, and what was it he predicted?
Well, it was just sort of one take. I mean, the fact was that the agriculture and economy of the Eastern Shore was pretty much broke anyway. There was nothing going on there, and there certainly wasn't any kind of a agriculture that needed or could sustain slaveholding of any kind. So it was really on the way, the so-called natural limit of slavery, the term that was used at the time, had clearly gone south during that part of the early part of the 19th century. So really, this calculating man, this archetypal Marylander in many respects, this person of the middle ground sort of saw it coming and figured, well, I can sell these slaves for 30 cents on the dollar to some Virginian, and Virginia will go to war to protect slaveholding, but Maryland won't. And, of course, as a novelist writing about history, we know that this character in his sort of brutal truth was in fact what came to pass.
And also the man who coins the phrase homo economicus. So he is indeed a man who makes his calculations and makes them pretty close. It's also a story about brotherhood. So tell us about Randall and Thomas.
Well, it's really the story, the sweep of the plot is two families after the war. One are the Masons and their sort of collateral family by marriage, the Baileys, the owners of the place, and what they're trying to do to create some kind of going concern with all these thousands of acres that no one had a clue what to do with. And the other family are the Terrells, long free blacks from that area, and who become Abel, the man of the family, becomes a manager of the farm alongside the Baileys, and there are two boys. There's Thomas, the son of the Masons, of the Baileys, and Randall, the son of the Terrells. And these two boys are identical in age and have grown up together and have formed what I describe as a kind of a spooky bond. And ultimately, it is the story of what happens to their relationship that kind of drives a good bit of the novel.
Can I get you to read another section that illustrates some of what you just said?
Sure. This is the two boys playing on the river, the Chester River. And it's really, I do have to say that before I even read this, that this is about me and my brothers. That this is the Dillman Boys in the 50s, even though I'm describing other boys in the 1870s. But they've had it out, a typical summer morning, and to see what they can find to do. And they've headed to the river. When they came to the bank, they jumped across the crumbled clay onto the sand and stones and headed down toward Piney Point, where they had a fort they'd hollowed out in the clay banks under the root ball of a pine just about to fall over into the waves. They hadn't been there in a while, and they agreed with a nod that it was Thomas's turn to poke his head in first to make sure bees or raccoons hadn't taken up residence in their absence. From the cave, they spent the rest of the morning collecting stones, red ones, black or white, luminescent shards of oyster shells, scissors, clams, and horseshoe crab peels. Over the years and the years to come, they would spend thousands of hours on the beach like this, way at opposite ends, consumed in the hunt, pawing through the piles for the perfect stone out of a million, and sometimes an arrowhead would be sitting there, first time in the light for 300 years, still sharp. And after an hour or two of solitary hunting, the boys would turn and draw back together and open their palms to show off the prizes, and they would agree without discussion which was the best, a pale ochre-red one banded with an unbroken white stripe, or a piece of quartz with a shape visible in the center like a ship in a bottle, or a perfect cube, a number 7, or a disc as flat as a wafer. They'd fling the rest in a shower over the water. Then they'd fling the best into the water. They took nothing away. There was no reason to. They'd walk along in the shallows, and when the jellyfish were there in numbers, they'd scoop them up and throw them at each other, a satisfying sort of ammunition. A jellyfish couldn't sting through the callus of the palm of your hand, but did a fine job on someone's naked back. Except that Randall and Thomas didn't try to do that. They didn't want to hurt each other. Randall said his black skin couldn't be stung the way Thomas's pearly back would be, and they both reckoned that this was true. Still, they hated it when one of them got hurt, fell hard, stubbed his toe, took a tree branch across the face. While the one cried, the other would curl down beside him and wait it out.
Christopher Tillman reading from The Right Hand Shore, his latest novel. He'll be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on Monday with us here today. You created a beautiful picture of their relationship, and you did it without dialogue. And I noticed that you do a lot of that. Do you try to stay away from dialogue? Is it something you just don't like much?
Well, I think of dialogue. I really began writing, or at least when I first began to have any sort of crumb of success at as a short story writer, and I still think of dialogue the way a short story writer does, which is that you're really not doing all the please pass the salt and hey, how you doing stuff. You're cutting more to the four or five lines back and forth that really contain the importance of the conversation. So I'm more interested in what people think, and I'm more interested in what people do than I am interested in what they say. So, you know, page after page of sort of unbroken text is a little boring to the eye as well as to the mind. But I really don't sort of accumulate sort of points through extended dialogue. And the other part about that is I just was never very good at it. You know, there's a certain kind of ear that pulls it off, and it's never been mine.
Christopher Tillman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's been great. Thank you.
Christopher Tillman's latest novel is The Right Hand Shore. He is teaching writing at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, and he'll be at Quail Ridge Books and Music Monday night, 7:30. Coming up next, the Bulltown Strutters strut their stuff live in our studio. Stay with us.